Hey, hey, beer fans. Welcome to Experimental Brewing with Denny and Drew. I'm Denny Kahn.
And I'm Drew Beecham. Together, we're the authors of Experimental Homebrewing, Mad Science in the Pursuit of Great Beer, and Simple Homebrewing, now available at all your finest retailers and other outlets soon to be discussed.
Yeah.
Now, between the two of us, we have over 50 years of homebrewing experience. I'm the guy known for weird beer and strange ideas.
And I'm the guy who's known for questioning the conventional wisdom and checking it out.
All right, and so on today's episode, it's going to be a quick episode as we catch up and get the year started. We're going to head over to the pub, talk a couple of pieces of news and some changes that are there, before we head over to the brewery to talk a little bit about what we've been doing or what we haven't been doing. And then, of course, we'll give you a quick tip, we'll give you something other, and we'll get you on your way.
So sit back, relax, we'll be right back after these messages. This episode of the Experimental Brewing Podcast is brought to you by you, our listeners. Go to experimentalbrew.com to help support us. Click on the Patreon link to donate whatever amount you like to the podcast and our charities. Click on the Brew Your Own Magazine link to subscribe to BYO. Or click on the AHA link to join the American Homebrewers Association. Part of the proceeds from those will go to help support the podcast. And thanks for your support. The ultimate all-in-one electric homebrewing system is here. The new Grainfather G40 can produce up to 11 gallons of beer and features all the latest advancements in homebrewing technology, including wireless control so you can monitor your brew day from the Grainfather app. With an innovative new grain basket design that improves workflow, reaching mash efficiencies of 75% or more is easy. The 3,300-watt heating element brings your wort to a boil quickly without any scorching, and the large hop plate filter guarantees that no unwanted grain matter or hop probe reaches your fermenter. Every G40 comes standard with a high-powered built-in pump that can handle temperatures over 200 degrees Fahrenheit and a full 3-year warranty that guarantees that you will be able to keep on brewing no matter what. The new Grainfather G40 is available now at your favorite homebrew retailer or online at grainfather.com. Welcome back. We're going to start off with announcements like we always do.
Yeah, and so the announcements are go pay attention to your feed because there's been a new episode of the Brew Files posted. So go listen to that. It is a replay, but we are getting back into the groove now that the year has started. So expect some new episodes before too long. And don't forget that you can support the podcast by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can click the AHA or BYO links on the website and by going to Patreon and pledging a buck or two or more to our charitable cause, which for this part of the year is
still up in the air. We are trying to decide on a charity for this part of the year, and we're looking for ideas. If you have an idea, something that is kind of like universal, will benefit animals or kids or something like that, please shoot us an email at podcastinexperimentalbrew.com and give us your suggestions.
There you go. Military puppies with cancer.
That's hard.
I don't
want
to think about such a thing.
That's right.
All right. And real quick, no feedback this week, although I do have to say we had a ton of feedback about the oxygen episode that we posted a couple weeks back. We are going to be getting together a response episode for that because there were some additional questions, some folks asking about the whole or talking about the whole starter and stir plate and oxygen exchange thing. So expect more on that soon, but it's a little bit much for us to address here.
If you say so, I could do it easily.
Okay, I know great. You could, but that's because you just want to go, no, you're wrong. Meh.
Nah, not necessarily.
All right. So without further ado, let's go grab a beer.
All righty. We're going to get out of here. We'll see you in the pub. We'll be right back. When I'm done brewing, I want to be done brewing, not waiting around for my wort to cool. With the Hydra, the Corny Pillar, and the other great chillers from Jaded, I can be done when I'm done. No more waiting 20 minutes for the wort to cool enough to add Whirlpool hops. No more messing with cleaning and sanitizing counterflow or plate chillers. With the super fast immersion chillers from Jaded, you can chill your wort in minutes without all the hassle. Jaded chillers aren't just works of art, they're the fastest, most effective chillers you can buy. Check them out at jadedbrewing.com. The 7th annual Pink Boots Blend from Yakima Chief Hops is now available in homebrew sizing on the Yakima Chief website. A portion of the sales will be donated to the Pink Boots Society in support of its mission to provide educational opportunities to women and non-binary individuals in the fermented and alcoholic beverages industry. This year's Pink Boots Blend consists of Ottenham, El Dorado, HBC 638, and Idaho 7, with the expected sensory notes of berry, citrus, stone fruit, and herbal. Place your order today at yakimachief.com/pink-boots-blend and brew your own Pink Boots Blend beer. Welcome back, and welcome to the Experimental Brewing Pub at the corner of everywhere and nowhere, somewhere in cyberspace. We're having a couple beers, and I'm going to let Drew tell you about his.
Yeah, so I'm going to a trustworthy brewery with a new beer that I hadn't had before, and oddly enough, I spotted this one in all places, the grocery store. I don't usually think of going to the grocery store and finding new beer, you know?
I do.
Well, okay, you got better grocery stores than I do.
Maybe so.
And this particular one is from Sierra Nevada, which you all know that I love and adore and trust what they're doing most of the time. And this is their Hop Bullet. And Hop Bullet is a double IPA, except for this is the special version, which is the Magnum Edition, which, you know, makes it sound sort of, you know, manly. This is a manly Magnum double IPA. But really what it is, it's a 9.5% double IPA that uses Magnum, Eureka, Helios hops, which I hadn't had before, and Idaho 7, right? It's very, very smooth. It's actually kind of rich tasting for what I would consider like a double IPA. Almost a little bit of that, not Caro, but more golden syrup sort of sweetness in the back end to it, but very pale. It does use oats in it, which I think is actually helping kind of give some of the body to it. But what I thought was really interesting, and since we know that Sierra Nevada is very much a stickler for their numbers. On the can, they talk about, okay, hey, it's 9.5%. It's a double IPA. And they say 48 IBUs, which...
48 IBUs for a double IPA?
Exactly. That was very much my response. But, I mean, the thing is plenty bitter, and it has a lot of hop character to it. But it was just kind of strange to me to go, wait, double IPA and 48 IBUs? What?
Really?
But they said this is, I believe it's going to be available until the end of February, and it's going to be widely available for Sierra Nevada. You know, so you can get both Bigfoot and Hot Bullet Magnum at the same time. And, I would suggest actually going and looking it up. They sell it in a six pack, which is also kind of nice. And a six pack of these cans, and, you know, it's a really good kind of end of the evening sort of beer because to me, and I think of that 48 IBUs and with how smooth a lot of those hops are that they're talking about, particularly the Magnum and the Eureka and Idaho 7. It's bitter, but it's not overwhelming. And it's got a nice alcohol kick to it. So it kind of makes a very nice nightcap beer for the IPA fan.
You know, I would have to question whether a 48 IBU beer can really be called a double IPA. But, and you know, given that they can call it whatever the heck they want to call it, it seems like they're kind of changing the definition of double IPA.
A commercial brewer changing the name to something that will sell?
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, at some point in time, it seems like, okay, IPA, that just means hops, and double just means strong.
Except this isn't strong.
I mean, 9.5% is pretty strong.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right, yeah.
So,
yeah, I was, again, I was just so stunned by the 48 IBU that I was kind of taken aback there.
Well, and particularly because I think about it, because we always talk about Sierra Nevada Pale Ale being sort of the perfect indicator of 35 IBUs.
Yeah, right.
Right? And so to think, like, this is supposed to be 13 more, it feels more bitter than that. But still, I thought that was pretty funny. But, hey, it's a widely available double IPA from Sierra Nevada. Pretty tasty. And like I said, it's a nice, you know, sort of ending the evening nightcap-ish beer.
Do you suppose the reason that it presents as more bitter is because of all the tannins from all the hops in it?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't get it as, like, an astringency.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I just got kind of like a big hop bite.
Well, I'll have to keep my eyes out, see if I can see any of that up here and check it out.
I'd have to imagine you will. Now, yeah. I also suspect the reason why that you are thinking 9.5% isn't strong is because of the beer you're having.
Well, it's not so much that 9.5% isn't strong, but I'm having a Straff Hendrick quadruple. They are in Bruges, Belgium. And unfortunately, I didn't know that until I came back from Bruges. I don't know how I didn't do better research and figure this out. This is the second beer I've had from them. I've had their triple also, which, as far as I'm concerned, is right up there with my beloved Westmalt triple. It's one of my favorite beers of all times. And this quadruple has just jumped up into my top beers also. It's an 11% beer. It has notes of chocolate, coffee, dark stone fruit. It is a little bit more, has a little bit more body than you would normally think of for this kind of beer, but not in a bad way. It is still very drinkable, very digestible. Lovely phenols coming from it. The esters are all kind of like dark stone fruits. There's none of that like banana bubblegum character that people often kind of refer to when they say, I'm going to ferment my Belgian beer at 80 degrees to get all those great Belgian esters. It's like, yeah, I know. Those are the esters you really don't want to get, as far as I'm concerned. If you want those esters, brew a Hefeweizen. But anyway, the Straff Hendrick quadruple, 11%, it is just a delicious beer. As a matter of fact, when I was looking online for information about it today, I found a place where I could buy a case for $7 a bottle. And boy, believe me, it's on my mind.
Temptation.
Yeah. Definitely. I probably won't because, you know, there's just no guarantee of the quality when you're ordering beer like that. But I'm tempted. I'm sorely tempted. But I've got another bottle in the fridge to last me and help me think about it.
Well, I'm surprised that you didn't know Straff Hendrick was there in Bruges because it's De Hoffman Brewery, right? I thought you went to De Hoffman.
No. I didn't. I would have if I had been there. I would have if I had known that it was there, but I didn't really do much research about breweries in Bruges. I just went there and saw what I saw, and that was it.
Right, and so for people who don't know, the Hoffman Brewery, the Hoffman, is in Bruges, in the old part of Bruges. And they have a tour, and they have the little pub and the restaurant and all that sort of fun stuff. And that's the place that I remember walking through, and you go and take the walk-around brewery tour that's self-guided. And you walk over the old fermentation floor, and you see the old fermentation squares. And they had, like, these sort of cast iron, enameled cast iron fermentation squares that are open-topped and had copper attemperators that went into them to keep the beer cool while fermenting. And you walk over those, and so that's where Straff Hendrick is brewed. They were also the ones who famously decided to install a beer pipeline under the street.
Yes, the bottle of the quadruple actually talks about that.
Yeah, they actually put a pipeline under the road from the brewery to outside the old town, so that they could actually deal with packaging and getting the bottles out without having to deal with all the oddities of being located in a medieval town.
yeah, right. The brewery has been there since 1856.
Yeah, And Bruges, of course, has been there way longer.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Bruges is like at the top of my bucket list, which is getting to be more and more buckety every day. But, you know, I really, really want to get back there. It's a beautiful spot. I just love the vibe there. And then there's all that great beer, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, just as long as your bucket doesn't have a hole in it. There's a hole in the bottom of the sea. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, moving on from the beers that we're having, and I sound like I'm having two right now, just wanted to give you guys an update if you haven't paid attention to your socials and kind of talk about it. So 10 years ago, actually, I guess now it's really been 11 years. 11 years ago, as we're talking, Denny and I were actively writing Experimental Homebrewing. How long did it take us to write that? It was like a year and a half, wasn't it?
I thought it was like 32 years.
It took forever, and much to the chagrin of our editors. But we were writing the book, and the book itself actually came out in November of 2014, so which I kind of consider surprising because it feels like it was longer ago than that, but here we are. So Experimental Homebrewing itself is out of print, sadly, unfortunately. There are still copies that you can find online, and we, of course, point you towards them to go buy and enjoy because we like having books on the shelf. But since the book is out of print and Denny and I retain the rights to the text, we are now actually publishing every month another chapter of the book online on our website. So for now until I think it's until October, the end of October will be the last chapter. We will be putting one chapter online every month. And not only will we be putting the chapters and the recipes and this, that, and the other on there, we're also going to be putting our annotated feedback about our reflections looking back on the book, right?
Yeah, and that might actually be, you know, one of the more interesting parts of the whole thing, seeing how the advice and techniques have held up over the last 11 years.
Yeah, and so, for instance, Chapter 1 and the introduction are online right now. You can go find those by going to the website at experimentalbrew.com, and up at the top in the menu right next to the link for the podcast, there's a link that says Experimental Homebrewing Online. You click on that, you start getting the chapters. The very first chapter, oddly enough, is the basics. Who would have thought? and the basics, it walks through, you know, some of the basic assumptions we're making in the book. But I think what's more interesting for you and I is we get into talking about not only, you know, okay, what you should you know about how to brew a basic batch of beer, but we also talk about how we do it. And so this, again, as I said, was written in about 2013. So 11 years ago, and it's interesting to me to see how much our process has changed over that time.
quite a bit, man, quite a bit.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, in here, you're talking about how you're brewing on your cooler with a toilet braid, right?
Right,
and
yeah.
I'm talking about how I'm brewing in a cooler as well, but with like a big industrial military shielded communications cable braid, because, And so it was funny to me to see that and then to realize, okay, well, since that period of time, you and I have both switched completely how we brew.
Yeah.
We're both now using the all-in-ones like a lot of people are. And so it was just kind of interesting to see that. Things about like how we make starters. Like you're talking about making a starter in a flask and all that sort of fun stuff and starting with, you know, this, that, and the other. And talking about how we now make shaken, not stirred starters. Now, I still do make my starter wort in advance. It's the only place I can actually think ahead to pre-prep, and so I still do that. But again, this was just in the first chapter that we put together, and and also chilling. It also changed how we chill.
Right.
And so it was just kind of cool to see, and you know, we're going to be doing this as we go forward with each of the books. Target is going to be sort of the last week of every month. We'll have a new chapter up, and you'll be able to see those, and hopefully y'all will enjoy that. And if you have any feedback about the experience, I know some of our Italian listeners said that one of their difficulties is dealing with the fact that the book is all in imperial units. I will work on making sure that we also include metric equivalents.
Or we could just include a calculator for people to convert themselves.
Yeah. But we'll make an effort for that. But if you have any feedback about this whole project, please let us know. podcast@experimentalbrew.com. I'm actually just pleased to see you know, the positive response about this. I saw a couple of people, like there was one of the Italian comments again, where they talked about how the book was a masterpiece.
Whoa.
I will totally take being something I do being called a masterpiece by an Italian any day of the week.
Yeah, no kidding. Man, he must have been drunk.
No. Just drunk on knowledge. Drunk on the knowledge that we're sharing in the book. But yeah, so again, last week of every month up until the end of October, we'll be putting a chapter online and look forward to seeing your feedback.
Yeah. Yeah, we really would like to hear what you think about it, and, you know, and especially, what you think about the changes and maybe even reflect on, if you've been brewing for as long as we have, how your brewing has changed over time also.
Yeah. So interesting little time capsule, almost, not quite as time capsule-y as, Palmer's How to Brew, online, you know, which had much more years in length.
Yeah.
All right, and so speaking of other sort of things that have been changing over time, we wanted to go over a couple of changes that we've been hearing about that the AHA has announced, just to get you guys an update on what's going on there. And, Denny, you want to walk through this?
Yeah, I'll do some of them. You know, the AHA has for many years, maybe their entire existence, had what was known as a governing committee. The name of that governing committee has just been changed to committee. They've taken out the governing part. Draw your own conclusions. The two members of that committee, generally the chair and one other representative, served on the board of directors of the Brewers Association to convey homebrewing concerns to the Brewers Association, which is, you know, you may or may not know, is the parent organization of the AHA. Those two AHA positions on the Brewers Association Board of Director have been eliminated. Let me see here. There will no longer be elections for committee members. They will be appointed. The competition, the National Homebrew Competition first round is now going to be in May and June. And they actually put out no details about what is coming up with HomebrewCon, GABF, all that kind of stuff. And I don't know if maybe they haven't figured it out yet or what. But anyway, there's a bunch of changes, being made in the AHA and its structure. And I'm not going to tell you what I think about it, and we're just going to see what happens.
Well, and of course, we'd like to know what you think about it, podcast@experimentalbrew.com. I do think there's some context that's important for people to know. So remember, okay, the AHA is the original organization, the organization of Charlie's creation, so shall we say. And then after creating the AHA, Charlie went on to go create the Association of Brewers, the AOB. Which you can still find reference to online. Back in, what, it was 2005, right? Back in 2005, the AOB merged with the Brewers Association of America, with Charlie becoming the boss over both of those units and combining that together into the Brewers Association, which is the organization that we know. So even back then in 2005, there was a big existential debate. Would that be the right way to put it?
Yeah, kind of that.
Like, should a professional organization have a sub-organization dedicated to hobbyists and amateurs? And at the time, because I think the AHA was the creation of Charlie, and that whole sort of system grew out of homebrewing, the AHA survived and was given a charter to sort of grow and do its thing. And Denny and I both served on the governing committee during periods of time when growing the membership was a very important thing. Growing the interest in the hobby was important. And now the BA, of course, is the big organization, and these are some changes. And it's interesting because in a lot of ways it feels like the AHA is sort of being packed off into a little box and off to the side. But we'll have to see what happens with that.
Yeah, You know, you just don't know. There's a lot of changes there, and we'll just kind of have to see how it shakes out.
Yeah. Well, and of course, I mean, part of it is that the hobby's declining in scope and population. Craft beer attendance and festivals is declining and in free fall. Craft breweries are having some issues, we've seen. The Brewers Association got hammered during COVID. There's a lot of things going on and a lot of kind of compaction of everything. So let us know what you think. podcast@experimentalbrew.com. Tell us what your thoughts, your cares, your concerns, et cetera, are about this whole thing.
Okay. And with that, we are going to head over to the brewery, tell you about what we've been brewing, what we haven't been brewing, what we hope to brew coming up, and how I screwed up my last brew. So stick around. We're going to be right back. The next generation of countertop home distillation systems is here. The all-new AirStill Pro from Still Spirits is a revolutionary still that will look right at home alongside your everyday kitchen appliances. This small batch 2-in-1 distillation system operates in either pot still or reflux mode and allows you to craft high quality light and dark spirits at home. No hoses, no complicated assembly, just plug and play. The AirStill Pro column cools itself with a built-in high-powered fan. The Still Spirits AirStill Pro is available now at your favorite homebrew retailer. Learn more about the AirStill Pro at stillspirits.com or check them out on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube. Welcome to the brewery, the land of the gleaming stainless steel, some days, and bubbling brew kettles and fermenters.
And right now, it's cobwebs.
Yeah, right. No kidding. You haven't brewed for quite a while, have you?
It's been a couple months, yeah.
Wow. Boy, you're even worse than me. But I did finally get around to sending Drew some of the batch of Denny Kong that I had brewed, and I'm curious to hear his opinion.
Yeah, now, normally this would be where we'd cut away to a live tasting. However, I wasn't very happy with how the audio came out because of some disturbances that were happening while I was recording. So first things first, so Denny sent me a bottle in his patented PET bottles. Remind the listeners again, you just bottle into those with a long piece of tubing off a cover line, right?
Well, not exactly, not anymore. I run a long piece of tubing through a stopper that fits the hole of the bottle. So first I shoot a bunch of CO2 into the bottle to flush it as much as possible. I seat the stopper in there. I attach the top of the tubing. I stick it inside a Cobra tap, open the Cobra tap, bottle fills an inch or so, then the back pressure stops it. At that point, I just kind of crack the stopper a little bit to release the pressure, and the bottle fills the rest of the way up.
Okay. So we get some O2 protection and some preservation of the carbonation. I will say that immediately the first thing I noticed was more carbonation than I've gotten in some of the past samples for me. So good on you.
Yeah, well, I was making sure of that, and that method really helps preserve that too, because I had just been sticking a tube into a Cobra tap and putting it in the bottle before.
All right. Well, so thinking back to the Denny Kong that we had, first, let's remind people. So this was using the Trial 702.
Right.
So that's the new slurry product from Yakima Chief. Using the proper things that we used before. Now, if I remember correctly, you didn't dip hop though, right?
No, I didn't. I decided that was a faff.
So how'd you add the 702?
I did a whirlpool with it for about 10 minutes.
There we go. All right. So we got the 702. So immediate things I noticed was, surprisingly, given that there are no caramel malts in this, the sample that I had actually had a fairly orange color to it. Now, I will also say, in fairness to Denny, I waited a little bit on tasting the sample, because every time I turned around, I had something else I had to do. But mine was a little bit orangey, and I wasn't sure if that was age, oxidation, or if that was something that came out of how your system made the brew.
Yeah, well, and a little bit orangey maybe compared to the original one. Yep. I should probably say that when I am doing one of my homage beers, I consider it a success if you can tell what the model I was going for was.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I don't worry about every little detail of it.
Yep. So a little bit more orange, a little bit more kind of a bitter orange peel sort of flavor to it as well. And then the hops were very bright in the aroma, and actually a fairly nice bitterness to it. What I thought was interesting was, in comparison to the commercial version that we had, it had a beefier back end to it, I thought.
Meaning what?
Meaning that, like, where the North Park version of the beer really sort of popped off the palate and dried out, like came to a very, like, not aggressively, but like a very firmly dry finish. The version that you sent me from home was a bit softer in the finish, right? It had a little bit more sort of, a little more residual sweetness in a way. I don't want to say that because I'm not trying to imply that there was extra sugar in there, but right. it felt like it had a little bit more heft to it.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind that besides the time you waited to drink it, that beer was probably at least a couple months old when I sent it to you.
Right. Well, and that's kind of what I was thinking. So I really wish I could have gotten to it a little bit earlier. But having said all that, it was a delicious beer.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, it's like, hey, you know what? This reminds me of Denny Kong. It's like, you know, 75% of Denny Kong, and I'm happy with that.
Well, and in truth, we also have to remember that you and I are not in the habit of professionally brewing IPAs again and again and again and again and again and again, like Kelsey is.
No. Yeah. Right. Well, you know, and then, of course, there's going to be differences because, you know, I had a different batch of hops than he did. Mm-hmm. You know, my system is a different system, so it affects the wort in a different manner. You know, so like I said, it reminded me of what Denny Kong was, and for me, that's a success.
Well, and the biggest thing was, yeah, it fell still into that firm category of the new IPA or the modern West Coast IPA or however you want to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because it wasn't. It didn't have the same sort of level of bitterness that I would expect from an IPA from you. Like if it was just raw, you doing what's in your brain, and how you know to make them. It had more upfront hop presentation in terms of flavor and aroma. And it fell straight into that model. So I was appreciative, and thank you for sending me the beer. I do actually have to go and make what I'm going to call the Denny Kong 2, Drurio's Revenge. and get you that, because I still have the 702 sitting here in the fridge, staying cold, so this is going to be good. All right?
Now. Yeah, well, I'll be looking forward to you sending me some of yours.
Yeah. All right. Now, in terms of other things I've been brewing, I haven't been brewing anything because I've been rebuilding a bathroom. turns out that if you're working on a bathroom or having people work on a bathroom, you have a lot of ancillary tasks that you have to do that doesn't make it possible for you to really go brew. So that's where I'm at the moment. But I've got a bunch of things on the horizon because May 3rd and 4th, it's going to be Southern California Homebrewers Festival time, and I got things I got to put together for that, for our Classics Bar. And that's, what, 2-3 months away now? So right about the time I got to get serious about brewing for that. So here we go. Got to make my mile, got to make a saison, got to make this, I got a bunch of things that are coming. So
yeah.
This is how it always works for me in brewing, is I sort of faff about for a good portion of the year, not really doing much, and then suddenly go, ah! And like brew everything at once.
Well, you know what, man? You got quite a challenge ahead of you to get all that done in that time.
Oh, it won't be a problem. And I will also say.
He says now.
I say now. All right. And I will also say for anybody who listened to the Old Foggy episode from last month, the Old Foggy, shockingly, is about to go on tap. So Wild Pear is pulling out the old foghorn, or not old foghorn, the old foggy, and putting it on tap. That's fully fermented. If you remember from the episode, we're talking with John about how he was going to barrel age it, and he ended up going and using those barrel spiles from the barrel mill. And you can go back and you can listen to my talk with Desi about those. And following that exact advice about soaking them in bourbon, getting them into the beer, leaving them there for a couple of days. And I will tell you what, the tasting samples I've had, that bourbon's coming off hot right now.
Yeah, I can imagine so, man.
So it'll be interesting to see how this is going to go. He only brewed, I think, 5 barrels of it. So a couple of it's going to go on tap for now. And then the rest is going to go hang out in kegs and go hide for a year. And then we'll have it again next year. So I'll be really curious to see where we are over the course of the year. But by the time you hear this episode, Old Foggy will be on tap at the Wild Parrot in Pasadena, California.
Great. And you'll send me some, right?
I'll do my dangdest. I got to see if he'll do. The only problem is he only does crowlers. I don't know if you need 32 ounces of a big old Russian beer.
No, probably not.
We'll figure something out.
Sure, you know.
All right. Denny, you alluded to it at the top of the segment. Yeah, Dick chimped a triple.
Yeah, I did. And actually, I discovered that I dick chimped my last couple beers. Unfortunately, the one prior to this triple recovered from it, my alt beer. So what it is, I decided, my West Coast Mall that I normally make is kind of a toned down version of West Mall Triple. It's not as hoppy and it is not as strong. And I decided I wanted to go for the real West Mall specs. I was shooting for like 9.6% and 39 IBUs. And during brew day, one of the first things I noticed was that I was getting continually stuck mash. My temperature would fluctuate from, you know, way low to way high, and because it just was not recirculating well. The other thing that I noticed was the wort was incredibly, incredibly cloudy. And I had seen that on my previous beer, an alt, where I did get the recirculation. The problem with the triple, let me just jump back to that, was that I was recirculating too fast. I had forgotten to turn down the valve, and I was pumping back over the top of the mash at full speed, full volume. And I know from experience that that is not a good thing to do. You know, back in the early days of Herm's systems, people would use a grant to get away from that. Because they couldn't throttle their pump speed. I wasn't smart enough to think of that. I just went on continually stirring the mash, trying to get the temperature to even out and the recirculation to run through. After an hour of hell, I gave up and started sparging. The beer finished a lot higher than I would have expected, especially given the fact that it was 20% sugar. I think that it started at 1086 maybe, and ended up at about 1020. Due to the 39 IBUs, though, the beer is not sweet tasting in the least. It is definitely very hazy. Well, what I had done on that beer and both and the alt also, which you may remember I had mentioned was taking forever to clear up, I'd used twice as much Brutan B as I should have. And that's the only thing I can attribute it to, especially when you consider that there are other of those gala tannins that are used specifically to make a beer hazy, right?
Right.
So I think by putting in a double dose of Brutan B, that might have been what it was. The alt eventually cleared up and turned into a delicious beer, so I just stuck that triple in my beer fridge, and I'm just going to forget about it and leave it there. And actually, the next beer up for me, hopefully in the next week or so, is going to be that triple once again, that same recipe, because there's a lot of potential in that recipe. And hopefully the memory of how I dick chimped this one will make me get the next one correct.
Be careful with your additives. They have dosage rates for a reason.
Well, you know what? When I looked around, I couldn't find what the dosage rate was supposed to be. I couldn't remember. I thought it was like half a teaspoon in the mash and half a teaspoon in the boil. And it turns out it's a quarter for each one of those.
Yeah, it's funny because we've said that often enough. You know?
Yeah, man, but like, you know, in a week and a half, I'm going to be 72 years old, and I just don't remember things anymore.
All right, note to self, write it on a post-it note and stick it on the Brutan B package.
Write to self, don't get old.
Well, no, I mean, look, given that we don't know what the alternative is, I can't exactly endorse that.
Okay.
All right, the basic problem is don't overdo your Brutan B, which makes sense.
And pay attention. I mean, you know, when I saw that mash sticking over and over and over again, it was like, why is this doing this? I've made this many, many times. I have never, ever in 26 years of brewing had a stuck mash like that. And, you know, for some reason, as I was going through the list of what did I do wrong in my head, mm-hmm. the one thing I totally missed was recirculating too fast, and that might be because I haven't done that before, so it never crossed my head that I would do that.
Well, here we are then. So just be careful. And by the way, it's funny that you mentioned the grants, because the second you said grant, the first thing that popped into my head was Anchor, because I don't know if you've ever seen the shots of the brewery before.
Yeah,
but Anchor, being an old school German brewery, like literally shipped over from Germany, they had big grants, and they were open air grants with these beautiful copper valves, and all that happened to, you know, like went into a big sort of tub, and then that fed the pump. Right.
Yeah. I was going to say, some of you may not know what a grant is, but because pumping from a mash tun too fast can compact the grain bed. For a grant, they would like kind of like run by gravity into, like Drew is saying, a tub or some sort of container, and then they would pump out of that.
Right. And the whole idea is twofold. One, not only to avoid sticking or depriving the pump and sticking the mash, but it's really to sort of make it so that you get all that nice, even gravity-fed flow across the mash bed, right, to, you know, hopefully reduce channeling and that sort of impact. And right. then take that out of multiple zones and then mix that back together and then pump that out. So, yeah, grants are old school technology, and I still kind of love them.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely one of those things that you probably don't want to use if you're concerned about oxygen in your beer.
Yep. So, but again, that's the funny part. Like when we talked about the oxygen stuff the other week and the other low-dose discussions that we've had. Yeah, I mean, that's an old German brew system. And, I mean, the grant literally pumped up out of these gooseneck, or didn't pump up, the grant fed up through these gooseneck faucets, you know, into a big open copper basin that then fed the pump. And there was actual, like, air contact time as the wort was spilling out of those faucets and going into the grant itself. So, kind of funny just to see, like, the old school technology going, low oxygen, what? So, there yeah. we go. All right. I think it's time for us to get out of here. Got to go brew something.
I think so. True Confessions time is over. We'll be right back in a minute, and we'll get you on your way for the rest of the day. Lyeast's fourth quarter legacy curation features two legendary strains for Autumn Brewing, 1968 London ESB Ale and 1728 Scottish Ale. These yeast strains were isolated 30 years ago for our culture collection and continue to be brewmasters' top choices for traditional malty European ales today. Both are regarded for their high flocculation and suitability for strong and seasonal specialty styles like double IPAs, smoked and barrel-aged beers, British bitters, barley wine, and more. Completing this curation are two limited-release lager favorites, 2000 Budvar Lager and 2001 Pilsner Urquell H Strain. Available now through the end of December, Budvar Lager delivers rich maltiness and subtle fruit notes while allowing hop character to come through in Czech lagers and German Helles styles. The Pilsner Urquell strain produces mild floral aromas and a clean, dry palate and full mouthfeel for Czech lagers and Bohemian-style Pilsners. Catch up on our latest blog posts and learn more about this release at yeastlab.com. Welcome back to the wrap-up today. Just want to let you know we got some great interviews planned coming down the road for this year, so please stick around, keep listening, and you can hear all of those. In the meantime, though, we have a quick tip and something other before we get out of here. I've got the quick tip today, and this is something that I learned after years of doing things the wrong way. God, that's a pretty common thing for me, isn't it?
And look, the best way to learn is to screw something up.
Yeah, right. Or, you know, or just forget about something until suddenly you make the discovery. In my garage where I brew, I have a little under-counter water heater. It's only 6 gallons, which is great for running into my sink and doing stuff there. But when it comes to cleaning kegs, other stuff, it is just completely inadequate. I suddenly realized that I had a water heater with a pump on it sitting there with my grandfather. So now for keg cleaning, I've started heating water in the grandfather, pumping it over to the keg for cleaning. I generally just rinse with cold water because that's pretty much good enough. But if you are short of hot water for cleaning time and you have an all-in-one sitting around, try using that as your water heating tank. You know, you've got the equipment already. Make use of it a different way.
Yeah, and I will also say this applies equally as well if you've got a propane burner. It's just easier if you've got an all-in-one to do this. Years ago, when my wife and I first moved in together, we lost the hot water in our house we were renting. And I will tell you what, I don't think my wife has ever been so happy that I was a home brewer as the day I said, "Honey, you need to take a bath, right? Here, I'll make you some hot water." And went outside and fired up the burner and filled my giant 20-gallon kettle, I think it is, 23-gallon kettle, filled it up, got the water nice and hot, and poured that into the bathtub so she could take an old-fashioned hot bath. You know? So remember, survival skills too.
Actually, I did something similar when we were having our bathroom remodeled. I filled up the G70, heated water in it, ran a hose from the output, hung it over one of the rafters in my garage with a spray head on it, and we had a shower.
I know, funny, right?
I know, man. It's one of those things when you go, "Whoa, I know what we can do," instead of going for a week without a shower.
There you go. And the universe thanks you.
Yeah, right.
Again, homebrewing, it's good for more than just making beer.
Yeah, right. Cleanliness is next to beeriness.
There you go. All right, and now for something other than beer, because life cannot be lived on just beer alone. I've been playing around with a lot of things recently, but the one that literally just dropped in my lap, thanks to a fellow club member, Alon, was Monsieur Spade, which is a short mini-series, a 6-episode special series. I don't even know what they call them anymore. I think back in the day it would have been a mini-series, but now they're just like limited series. And it's on AMC or AMC Plus if you are a streaming sort of person. And it is so far 3 episodes. I think it's going to be 6 total. It's a series that is a co-production of America and France, so Canal Plus, with Clive Owen starring as Sam Spade, who is retired and is the 1960s, and he's living in the south of France and gets involved in a case that comes up that kind of ties back together into the world of the Maltese Falcon and all this sort of fun stuff. In fact, the reason he's in France originally is he's trying to deliver Bridget O'Shaughnessy's daughter to her father after Bridget O'Shaughnessy died. If you remember Bridget O'Shaughnessy, congratulations. You know the movie and the book very well. And so it's just really kind of cool with Clive Owen playing like sort of an old kind of half-broken down Sam Spade in France, speaking French and speaking English, and you know, playing this sort of world-weary detective as a very dark and sort of disturbing case pops up around him, and he kind of gets looped into it. Yeah, kind of like all good noir detective fiction. So that's Monsieur Spade. It's on AMC, AMC Plus. As we're recording this, 3 episodes have been released. I can tell you right now that the composer for this series has definitely been studying their Jerry Goldsmith, because the soundtrack sounds like it was straight up lifted from, or not lifted, sorry, to use Denny's term, straight up homage.
there you go.
Straight up homage to Jerry Goldsmith's scores from both Chinatown and L.A. Confidential. So.
Wow. I heard an interview on NPR with Clive Owen talking about it. It sounds very interesting, but I don't get AMC, so I'll wait till it shows up somewhere else.
There you go. I'll give you my password.
No, I don't do that. Never. As close as I do is use a VPN to watch British shows.
There you go. But yeah, so again, that's on AMC and AMC Plus. I've been enjoying it. If you're a fan of old school crime fiction, I think you'll enjoy it too. So there you go.
Cool. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening to another hour of Experimental Brewing Silliness. You can catch all of our latest adventures and writings. And don't forget that our first book, Experimental Brewing, will be there too. And our website, experimentalbrew.com. You can follow us on X, where we're at EXP Brewing. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. Drew hangs out on the homebrewing subreddit and the Slack homebrewing channel. I hang around the AHA discussion forum, Facebook, and several other places you can catch me. If you want to ask us questions, suggest topics, recipes, experiments, or even just rant and rave, you can email us at podcast@experimentalbrew.com. Or if you want to get a hold of us each individually, I'm Denny at experimentalbrew.com, and he's Drew at experimentalbrew.com. And of course, we have technology. You can leave us a voicemail or send us a text message at 626-765-1ALE, 626-765-1253. So until next time, remember to always brew experimentally.
Or brew wacky.
And we'll see you on the next episode of Experimental Brewing.